Good morning, Carborough and Chapel Hill. This is Wilf's wake-up call. My name is Dick Paddock, and I'm going to be a sort of a short-term host here. I want to wish you all a happy new year and bring you today's show, which is actually a rebroadcast of the interview we did with Pete McDowell 2 weeks ago. The interviewer was Tana Hartman, and I'm going to replay it because we're going to continue the discussion that takes place in this show next week, and we thought it would be appropriate to rebroadcast this so that the continuity would be there between the weeks. So here we go with Tana Hartman and Pete McDowell.
Good morning, and welcome to your wake-up call. My name's Tana Hartman. I'm your host today. Our engineer is Dick Paddock. And here to talk with us about Copenhagen. Like most people, my eyes and ears have been trained on Copenhagen this week, trying to figure out what was going on and if we have any hopes at all of coming away with a meaningful agreement. It doesn't look like we do, but maybe not all hope is lost. Here to talk with us today is Pete McDowell. He is the program director for NC WARN. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Copenhagen, what is happening there?
Well, as we speak, it is down to the wire. This is the last day. It's very doubtful that there will be, or put it this way, there may be something that they try to do that looks like a face-saving deal, but it's clear that there's not going to be a binding agreement. There may be some political agreement. It would be likely to have some settlement that puts money on the table for underdeveloped countries to mitigate against the climate change that they're seeing and to help reduce their...
This is the $100
billion? $100 billion is with a bunch of strings attached, which is what Hillary Clinton has put out yesterday.
Yeah. One country said, you can't ask us to choose between our hospitals, our schools, and our environment.
Right. The second piece would be some verification mechanism on whether countries are actually reducing emissions. The U.S. says that China needs to do that. China is moving a little bit toward that. A third piece is the notion of setting some goal, probably 2%. I'm sorry, 2 degrees Celsius as the maximum limit of temperature rise that we're going for. The African and underdeveloped countries saying that's way too much. You need 1.5% at most. Some are saying 1%, and one of the reasons is that in Africa, a 2% worldwide 2 degrees worldwide translates to 3 or 3.5 degrees in the south, which puts a whole lot of people at risk. We can talk about that later, but essentially, it will be a interim political, not binding kind of agreement at most. That's the way it looks as we speak. We'll know more later today.
Well, what's the sticking point? Why among the people who are there? I mean, first of all, in a venue that holds 15,000, they authorized 45,000 to come. Maybe they thought only a third would accept, but you know, lots accepted. And so they've been turning people away. But one of the people they did not turn away, of course, is Jim Rogers, CEO of Duke Energy, who got there, spent 4 days lobbying and talking with people, among them the head of China's largest energy company, ENN. And I'm sorry, I don't know what that stands for, but I know that they have apparently made some kind of a deal. I read in one of the trade papers. What is all of this about? You know, because it looks to me like I studied history. I studied the 16th, 17th century when little principalities were becoming nation states and about the politics and economics of that. What it looks like to me is that we're seeing a change, a global hemispheric consolidation of power, and this is capitalist power, you know, control of the market. They're carving up our globe into marketing sectors.
They're also carving up our sky.
Skies. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, one analyst talks about it. A number of people talk about it this way. If you put a 2-degree limit on what you try to do, a 2-degree limit on what temperatures going to rise, then the question of who gets to pump carbon into the atmosphere and who doesn't to fill up that remaining part of the sky, and that to keep below the 2 degrees. And that, so the sky, the essentially atmosphere, becomes a very valuable resource, and the big powers are moving in to claim that resource for themselves rather than for the underdeveloped countries and saying, we need to keep developing. You need to not be tightening the screws. We're not going to tighten the screws on each other's or on the Duke Energies.
You're not going to poison the air, but we'll poison it for you? I mean,
what
is this?
We're going to poison the air. We can't let you poison the air or develop. And therefore, we need to basically keep the balance of development the way it is. We don't cut back, but you cut back. And, of course, this has led to a huge battle that has really characterized the climate talks between the underdeveloped world and the developed world. The underdeveloped world is saying, you are, first of all, you're putting us in a situation where it's very hard for us to develop. The consequences of the global warming are hitting us hardest in Africa, in Latin America, in the Philippines, certainly in the Pacific Islands that are going to be, many of which will disappear. And we need, there's a climate debt that you owe us. You've been pumping this stuff in the atmosphere. We're having the consequences. We got to have money for mitigation, for doing the taking our population to where they can live, to doing that whole resorting out of our societies, to figure out how to deal when our rivers are drying up, when the monsoons fail, when all this happens. You have to put serious money on the table to help us do that, and we have to have a deal that stops, that really slows down in a very serious way this climate change, because it's killing us.
Yes.
It's really killing us. But the facts of the matter is the global balance of power is such that they are getting the short end of the survival stick, in a very real way. And of course, the bigger thing is we're all getting the short end of the survival stick.
Yeah, I mean, for what kind of a world are we leaving for our children and grandchildren?
Well, it's not our children or grandchildren. It's right now. That's one of the
really?
Critical thing. Kofi Annan's new think tank has said, I think it was in May, that 300,000 people this year have died because of climate-related disasters. It is happening right now. There are huge migrations and stress in Africa. We all know about the Arctic melting. We know about the glaciers melting. Now there's real issues about the Himalayan glaciers melting very fast. That feeds all the major rivers in that end of the world, from the in India and China and so on. The monsoon is all screwed up, which is the basis of agriculture in Asia. One of the things we have to do is shift the notion that climate change is in the future. It's not in the future. It's right now.
Okay. All right.
And of course, it will get worse in the future.
Yeah.
But for much of the world, we don't see, we don't, you know, it's just nicer days in December in North Carolina right now. It's not nicer days in December sub-Saharan Africa. It's no water in sub-Saharan Africa. It's, we can't grow things anymore. We've got to move, and we've got no place to move and nothing to move and no resources to move, you know.
So, I mean, it is affecting us, and I know it's going to affect growth cycles and stuff for certain types of plants, and it could devastate certain types of species rather quickly. And I know that it's accelerated a lot. I also know, however, that that the investments in renewable energy sources have doubled in the last 2 years alone, and that these companies are, a lot of these, you know, big power players are saying that they're investing in it, and the market seems to be taking off. It seems to be paying attention to renewables, but that's not enough.
Well, there's a real argument that actually that's not happening.
It's not.
It's not. According to The Economist, last week, The Economist magazine, there's been a real dip in investment in renewables. It has to do with the credit markets, that kind of thing. But the other reason that renewables, there's not enough investment is that we don't have a price on carbon right now. So, you know, Duke Energy still gets to build Cliffside. There's big new coal plant, old style, you know, no sequestering carbon coal plant that they're building west of Charlotte that us and a bunch of other groups in North Carolina are fighting. Duke Energy is building another coal plant in Indiana in Edwardsport that also will sequester. That's supposed to sequester, but very, very little. I mean, much less. They were hoping to do 18%, but they backed off that now. So you've got with no real constraints on belching coal, belching CO2 in the atmosphere right now. There's no it makes less economic sense to invest in renewables. And renewables are important, but in terms of consequences, the most important thing is energy efficiency. And I just want to tell you.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to tell you one little story. There's a bill called NC Saves Energy that 35 groups, NC Warren included, are pushing for in the North Carolina Assembly. It would be freestanding, uncontrolled by the utilities. It's based on a model that's been very successful in other states. With a very small fee on residential utility bills, it would create a big pool of money to be invested in energy efficiency, and to create green jobs and so on and so. But I want to tell you a story about what happened.
Okay.
With that.
All right. And then I have a question, because when you said a small fee, that seems to be the one thing in the poll that was done just last week, AP poll of 1,000 people. The one thing that stopped them from saying, "Oh yes, I want to do something about this," was the addition of any fee. No, they don't want to pay fees. Yeah, let's do something. I don't want to pay for it.
That's right. So what happened? This was coming up before the first committee in the North Carolina House. Our side had the votes in that committee. When the utilities found that this bill was going to move, they, the day before, put in six teams of three lobbyists apiece, 18 lobbyists, flipped four of our votes. The bills, we didn't, the chair was smart and didn't call the vote on that. But these, the folks who flipped and the opponents of this were reading pre-scripted arguments against this bill. The utilities do not want energy efficiency. They're in the business of selling energy. The last thing they want is people to cut back on their energy use. They say they're for energy efficiency. It's greenwashing, largely.
But didn't you, I thought it was you or someone said recently that here was a chance for Jim Rogers to turn himself into a hero to actually...
He's had a whole lot of chances. He has a chance every day to turn himself into a hero.
And that,
he can say he's going to stop building coal plants. I mean, building coal plants now, in a time of climate change, you know, that one coal plant, Cliffside, will put out 6 million tons of CO2 a year, equivalent of 1 million cars a year. Every just think of all the green initiatives that people of good faith are doing across the state. It pales in a comparison with what Jim Rogers is going to be pumping out from his coal plants. And of course, what we've got to do is we've got to move very quickly to phasing out all the coal plants in this state.
Right.
We had a study that was done by John Blackburn, the former chair of the Duke Economics Department, that said with modest energy efficiency, modest renewables, some more cogeneration using existing industrial boilers and so on, places that create electricity or make steam or using them to do both, we could be retiring 7 to 9 coal plants, existing coal plants. First of all, we don't need Cliffside anyway, but we could be retiring a number of other coal plants very, very quickly. Yep, Progress just announced, because they essentially had to, that they're going to be closing 11 coal plants in the next 25 years. In the next 7 years.
Oh,
these are very, they had to essentially under the clean smokestacks, they had to either put scrubbers on them. These are things that didn't have scrubbers, that were still polluting. Okay. Polluting. They were largely small plants that weren't used very much.
Okay.
But that's
a
step in the right direction. Yeah. If we're going to get, do what we need to do on climate and do North Carolina's part, job number one is closing coal plants.
Closing coal plants. Hold that thought.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. I just need to say you are listening to your wake-up call coming to you from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. You can visit our website and you can click and listen to past programs that are archived there. It's www.trianglewilf, as one word, and that's WILPF. Trianglewilf, WILPF.org. Our underwriter is Internationalist Books, 405 West Franklin Street, and their website is www.internationalistbooks, again one word, internationalistbooks.org. They're a great community resource. And we're back with Pete McDowell from NC Warren talking about carbon, trying to save the planet.
Yeah, just a couple more figures to put things into perspective. Jim Hansen is the foremost climatologist in the U.S. He's the guy who really put global warming on the map. And as he and many other climate scientists say, we have to be putting out no more than 350 parts per million of CO2.
And where are we now?
390.
Okay.
We've got to be reducing that carbon in the atmosphere very quickly. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the big UN body.
Yeah. Let me just say quickly,
yeah.
This group won jointly with Al Gore the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007, I guess it was, and they were created by the UN Environmental, the Environmental Program, and what other group? Anyway, but they are a program created by at the request of the General Assembly, and they have been very active. They've done a lot of research. None of them are paid. They're all volunteers, but they do have to have approval, a rigorous approval process through governments. So.
This is essentially the whole body of climate scientists in the world that that are crunching the numbers for the UN on this. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, they said, essentially, we have 7 years. That's a figure. We have 7 years to start having our global emissions go down. They're going up. They've gone up. What's the figure? 30% since 1992. We are our business as usual trajectory. Is maybe it was 1997, I'm not sure of that number, but our business as usual trajectory in terms of pumping emissions into the atmosphere is global suicide. We have got to do a huge change to bring those emissions down. They have to start going down by 2015, 2020 at the latest. We are not on that path at all. What the UN is saying and is the consensus is we need to be bringing them down somewhere between 25% and 40%. That much of a cut by 2020, that would be a huge task. The U.S. in the climate bill, which now is stuck in the Senate, if that did what it's supposed to do. The U.S. contribution, instead of 25% to 40% in by 2020, would be 4% cut. 4% cut. The whole climate bill the U.S. climate bill is driven by politics of the politically possible rather than the politics of the scientifically necessary, and you have this combination of the coal industry, the nuclear industry, the oil boys driving that whole process. Unfortunately, a number of the larger environmental groups, some of them holding their nose, some of them not, have joined in that process and say we've got to, you know, something's better than nothing. We've got to pass something. We don't think that's the case. We think that climate bill, as Jim Hansen says, the success of the climate bill would be a disaster. And and what we instead of this cap and trade notion, which is essentially a way of setting up a mechanism in which you trade indulgences, again Jim Hansen says, it was like the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. You sin, you emit too much. What we do is sell you an indulgence to offset it by supposedly growing trees in a South American country or something like that. You get to keep pumping out your emissions, and there's a cap and trade. The trade part is that you're able to trade offsets or lower emissions to other companies, other entities for a cost. The cost keeps going up, supposedly, but the end result is it becomes more and more costly to make okay. emissions, but you have there's a long line lag time. There's a whole lot of very lobbyable, very gameable complexities. It really hasn't worked. They've been doing cap and trade in Europe. It really hasn't worked. It's okay. been gameable. And what we need instead is it's what's called a fee and dividend or a carbon tax kind of bill. What essentially that would do is say, we're going to have a cap on carbon that's going to keep going down. There's going to be if you emit 10 tons of carbon, there's a clear tax on that. That tax will be paid back to you. The fee and dividend that Hansen likes is. We tax carbon. You're paying more for your gas. You're paying more for your electricity bill and that sort of thing. But you're getting a check back every month from the government saying the money that we're collecting by making carbon more expensive, we're giving back to you. Now, if you can be more efficient, you'll essentially get more money, or your net will be bigger. There's a real incentive.
So are there any limits on how that money can be used? I mean, they need to put it into energy.
No. It's you. We're collecting this money by taxing everybody in terms of the amount of carbon they put in the air. You get the money back to spend the way you want, but it sure makes good sense for you to get more energy efficient. It sure makes good sense for companies to invest in renewables and energy efficiency rather than just buying, quote, cheap energy.
It makes sense. I mean, it makes sense to me, and I wish we could talk more about this, but we're running out of time, and I'd like for us to get to what is it? I mean, what is it we need to do right now? How do we turn this around?
The good news coming out of Copenhagen is there is a major worldwide social movement building. It's on climate. It's on social justice. There were a huge number of students in the street. There were this week there were 1,000 people arrested in civil disobedience. That is going on worldwide. There's, I'm an old guy. I was there in the 60s. I know what that social movement, that time of ferment, the civil rights and the anti-war and the poverty, Poor People's March and all that stuff was in huge ferment. It was coming together as a huge combined social movement just before King was assassinated, and it blew up after that. And unfortunately, it never quite gelled. It's got to gel this time, and we have climate, and the justice issues around climate is one of the main drivers. But we have this huge growing inequality in the country and in the world, unprecedented. That's the other big driver. Dick Paddock and I yesterday were at the HK on J meeting. That's Historic Thousands on Jones Streets. That's led by the NAACP. There's a 14-point agenda. There's a huge march on. It's going to be this next year on February 13th. It has a 14-point agenda on racial justice, on poverty, on healthcare, on war, but also on green jobs and climate. We've got to put these issues together. We've got to be joined. As Reverend Barber, the leader of the HK on J movement and the head of the state NAACP, said, "What do we got to do? We've got to each be going to more meetings."
Oh boy.
We've got to be going to more meetings because time is running out on all these issues. We've got to build this movement. And we've got to be working locally. We've got to be working statewide. We've got to be working. We've got to be working nationally. We've got to be working politically. Every candidate who's running has to be asked, "Are you taking money from Duke Energy? Are you taking money from Progress Energy? Why? What are you going to do about energy? What are you going to do about social justice? What are you going to do about poverty?" And so, you know, I mean, we went through in my subcommittee this meeting yesterday just what had happened on these kind of issues in the last legislation the last legislature, and the answer was very, very little. The North Carolina General Assembly is run by business. By and large, that's and campaign contributions and lobbyists. The same thing is happening in the Senate. It's our government. It's our government that makes these critical issues. It's been taken away from us. We've got to get it back.
We've got to get it back. That is probably the place we're going to have to stop to wrap up. For folks who want to know more about this, I actually wish we can talk about continuing this conversation more about the actual, the nuts and bolts here of how to build this kind of a coalition, this movement you're talking about. But right now, how do people get more information?
Well, we have a lot of information on our website. It's NC Warren. Just Google NC Warren. It'll come up. A lot of information on climate, on the coal fight, on the whole fight against building more nuke plants and safety of nuke plants. There's a lot of information there. There are there's great information that comes out from Jim Hansen. You can sign up for his newsletters that he puts out that are really really amazing. Yeah. There are a lot of excellent sources, and maybe in the next program we can talk about some of those good sources.
I would very much like, and I hope we'll try very hard to do that. Thank you. We're going to have to wrap up there. You've been listening to the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Your wake-up call, this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.